This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Professor Roger Geiger from the Penn State University Department School of Education. Welcome, Roger. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
You can hear me all right?
Yes.
We're talking with him by phone. Are you in University Park?
Well, in State College, which is the name of the town.
Aha. And we're interrupting you on a Sunday afternoon at your home, and thank you so much for spending time talking with us about the state of higher education in the United States over the last 30 years. A friend of mine had recommended a particular paper of yours to me, a friend in Indianapolis, when we were talking about higher education, and she thought that this particular paper, she's also in your field, really encapsulated so much information that it would be helpful for me and for our listeners to talk with you about it, and I sure appreciate your being willing to do that.
Well, thanks. The paper was intended to kind of synthesize a number of the things that I've been writing about over the years, and also, I think it comes at a time when we need to sort of take stock of where we are.
And for some of our listeners who may not know Professor Geiger's work, he's a distinguished professor at Penn State, senior scientist at the Center for the Study of Higher Education. His own education, higher education, was at Michigan, where he did all three of his degrees, including a Ph.D. He was then at Yale and then has been at Penn State since 87, if I have that right.
That's right.
He's the author of several books and co-editor of books and many articles, and is a sought-after speaker on the whole topic of higher education. So let's talk about some of the important issues, and particularly as it affects values and the values of higher education for the people who are going through it. And I thought we might start by talking about what you talk about in this particular paper about the gap in higher education between rich and poor, between the selective universities and the non-selective ones. Could you define some of those terms for our listeners to start with?
Sure. One of the major, American higher education has always been a hierarchy. We've had very good institutions and marginal ones, but over the last generation, there's been more of a separation almost a bifurcation, and the selective sector has kind of separated itself. And the selective sector is one basically that has selective admissions of undergraduates, and that includes the private research universities, the better liberal arts colleges, and most of the flagship public universities.
Like Penn State and the University of Illinois.
Absolutely.
Right.
Even though they take in a large number of students, they're still fairly selective, and they get very good students.
And since this program is heard in Indiana as well as Illinois, I should mention Purdue and Indiana University, of course.
Absolutely. These are the institutions that value and compete for quality, both quality in the students that they're recruiting, but also in their faculty. In the rest of American higher education, everybody likes quality, but it's not something that they invest in very heavily and stake their reputation on.
In those very highly selective schools compete with one another for the same students and faculty, the very fairly highly motivated students and very very accomplished faculty.
That's right. And of course, the universities are heavily engaged in research as well, which is an important part of their function.
Let's talk a little bit about what's the gap between the poor students and the absolute best students. You reported that it's really grown over the last 30 years. It's increased.
That's right. It's probably been increasing over the last 50 years or so. Okay. as students have had greater mobility, and better students just tend to migrate towards the better institutions. But that process was really kind of frozen for a long time in the late 60s and 1970s. And the word elite was in very bad odor. And the students tried to go through college as fast as they could or start in junior college and so forth. And it wasn't until the 1980s, that this re-emphasis on selectivity and institutional quality began to show itself. And probably the biggest sign of it was the rankings of universities that appeared in the U.S. News and World Report for the first time in 1983, and then probably even surprised the magazine that they became so hugely popular.
Yeah, it may have saved the magazine.
This development was paralleled and really made possible by the revolution in financial aid and the beginning of the loan culture. And it was that development, which also began around 1980, when student loans became freely available to people regardless of income for a short time. The private universities then began raising tuition at a fairly rapid rate and allowing students to finance their education through financial aid and then providing their own financial aid, institutional financial aid, to sort of make up the difference. And this allowed them to eliminate price resistance because the students who had difficulty affording college were given financial aid, and then of course the wealthier students were willing to pay more, so they were able to increase their quality substantially and to really reduce the considerable problems, financial problems they had throughout the entire 1970s. So these two things worked in tandem. People became more sensitized to academic quality and willing to pay more for it, and institutions kept raising their prices and getting away with it, being able to really invest in greater facilities and everything else.
Now, when the private research, the very top private research universities raised their tuition and, as you say, also increased their student aid and the government was helping with student loans, how did the public top research universities respond?
Well, the publics at first didn't seem to think that was their concern at all. At the end of the 1970s, public finance for higher education sort of reached a peak. In fact, I showed data that in 1977 was the largest spending per student in state appropriations for higher education. That was 35 years ago. And it's sort of oscillated since then, but obviously we all know it's headed down today. So it was the recession of 1980-1981 that caused the first sort of crisis in state financing, in which they withdrew some of the financing from higher education. Universities responded by raising tuition. And then the same thing happened again in around 1990, 1991. And it happened again in 2001. And then, of course, it's happened again with the Great Recession. And so altogether, about one quarter of the cost of higher education in public universities has been transferred from the state to the students, their parents, and their loans. So in that sense, the public universities really can't go into tuition discounting the way the privates do. But they've kept moving in that direction, really, in order to compete with the privates.
They have raised tuition, and they have made some shifts, as to, you point out, for example, bringing in more out-of-state students who do pay higher fees.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. But what the public universities can't do is provide the institutional financial aid, the tuition discounting, which the privates do.
They don't have the scholarship aid to just give grants to the students.
No, because they don't have enough rich students. For this high tuition, high aid formula to work, you need an awful lot of wealthy students who are paying most of full tuition.
And let's let listeners know who may not have young people in college at the moment. You point out that it costs at the top private institutions these days $200,000 to send a student there for 4 years.
Easily.
Yeah.
And of course, not very many of the students actually pay that.
Right.
I've calculated that a tuition bill of that size can be reasonably afforded by about 5% of the families in the 45 to 55 year old demographic.
Oh.
So that's really a fairly small group.
Right.
So anyone else gets financial aid.
Now, we've been talking about the top institutions and the students who can get in them. They're all academically gifted, and they have great records and all of that. But the gap between them and the poor students, poor economically, and those who perhaps haven't had the benefits of great prep schools and great high schools and have really struggled to get into college at all. And that second group, you point out, less than half typically will graduate from 4 years of higher education.
That's right, and it's not unusual. But it's a disturbing figure because we don't seem to be able to get that graduation rate much above 50%
of those who start college somewhere.
Yeah. And the rising price of college certainly has an effect. It discourages students, it makes them attend part-time, work part-time jobs. All of these things make academic progress just that much more difficult.
Let me reintroduce our guest for listeners who may have joined us after the start of the program. Here on Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking about higher education with Professor Roger Geiger from Penn State University. And he's a senior scientist at the Center for the Study of Higher Education there. He's published many books and articles about the history of higher education. We're talking with him by phone from State College, but we're happy to have listeners ask questions or make comments. You can do that easily by phoning us. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois listening area, you can punch in 333-9455. Anywhere else, if it's a long-distance call, including if you're listening on the Internet, 1-800-222-9455. So if it's a 217 area code, you can punch in 333-9455. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Geiger, when you look into the history of higher education, you see these gaps, for example, between what the more less well-prepared students can do. I was surprised you pointed out that when there's such a low graduation rate for the poor, less prepared students, it actually increases the earning potential of those who are better prepared and more affluent.
Well, that argument is not mine. It was.
I guess you quote it. That's right.
Yes, book by Claudia Golden and
Thomas Mortensen. I see. Yeah.
Lawrence Katz and Claudia Golden have worked on they're both economists at Harvard, and they've worked on the economics and demography of higher education for years. And they just came out with a book, The Race Between Education and Technology. But their concern, and the concern of many people, is the fact that the productivity of higher education, that is the number of people graduating from higher education, where the United States led the world throughout the 20th century, has fallen considerably. And so there are many people that believe that we really need more college graduates in our labor force, and the argument of Golden and Katz is that this deficit of college graduates has caused a decrease in productivity and an increase in what's called the wage premium. That is how much college graduates earn over and above what a high school graduate would expect to earn. So in that sense, you know, insofar as there's a shortage of college graduates, their higher wages are due to the fact that other people aren't going to college or graduating from college.
It's interesting to me, one of your books is called Knowledge and Money, and I should say quickly, I've not read that volume, but the subtitle is The Paradox, the American Research University and the Paradox of the Marketplace.
Yes.
So you point out that students 30 years ago, when asked what they really wanted to achieve from their higher education, I think it was only 40% or something, said to achieve a real high standard of living, a big mm-hmm. paycheck was the highest priority for them, the highest value. But you point out that students, when interviewed more recently, about 77% of them would pick that as the main reason they're in school.
Yes, that's the largest reason that's given for attending college. So
that's a huge change over 30 years.
It's become much more materialistic, I guess.
Or practical.
It depends. If you get a good education, you should be able to earn a good living. Of course, if just making money is your object, then you go into certain fields.
Right. And you point out that more and more students have chosen to study business.
That big change really occurred probably at the end of the 70s, 1980s, when up to a quarter of students were graduating as business majors. And since then, actually, the business schools have gotten more selective. So it's a little bit less than a quarter now. And at the same time, business schools are getting much better students than they used to.
But you express some reservation about sort of that trend. Maybe it's more in the tone of what I've read that you've written. tell me why you think there's...
Maybe it's because I'm an historian.
Okay.
No, it's one of the major trends of the last 30 years has been this trend towards vocationalism. And I call it vocationalism. Other people would say professional education. And it has its positive and its negative aspects, I think. Universities are providing more, on the positive side, universities are providing more professional education on the postgraduate level, particularly master's degrees and professional certificate programs, much of which is now being made available online. So this is really the kind of very positive contribution that universities can make to enhancing the capabilities of the labor force. At the other end, vocationalism is people going to college just because just for the reason of getting a job is strongest in the for-profit sector, which is the fastest growing segment of higher education.
Now, these are colleges and universities that are not, they are let's see, they're corporations for profit to make money.
Oh yes.
Right.
These are and that's a big change over the last 30 years too. There used to be a lot of proprietary technical schools, and now they've all become corporatized, parts of big corporations like the University of Phoenix and Apollo Corporation and so forth. And their purpose is growth. They simply try to keep growing because that's what makes their stock price go up. And and secondly, they depend almost entirely on federal student financial aid, particularly loans. So you have students getting education in fields that are not very well paid and borrowing large amounts of money to do so. This is something that the Department of Education is dealing with right now, and if you follow the news at all on this, there's a constant sort of confrontation between the Department of Education trying to put more controls on student financial aid for these schools, and the corporations themselves, which have a great deal of political influence.
So they're hiring lobbyists as well to keep that student aid coming.
Yeah, they're one of the most effective lobbying outfits in Washington.
Wow.
So that's part of the trend towards vocationalism as well. But what's happened is that the most of the open sector of higher education, that is the not the selective sector, has become heavily vocational, and that means that it's largely most of its bachelor's degrees are intended as terminal degrees, whereas in the selective sector, large numbers of students intend to go on. You know, it's not like they're not interested in their careers, but they see their careers as becoming doctors and lawyers and professionals after they pursue graduate work.
These selective institutions, you have an interesting section in the paper I read on changes in American higher education from 1980 to 2010. You have a section that talks about the ways these private colleges and public research universities compete. And you list various sort of I forget the term you used, something like...
Is that the new quadrivium?
Yeah, and there's sort of a war between universities to get these selective students and to keep their own status high as a result of the ones they get. But talk to our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, a lot of the competition is takes place in what I call amenities, having... athletic facilities, beautiful dormitories, sumptuous meals. Boy, has college food ever changed over the last 30 years. But what I was referring to there specifically is kind of a hypothesis or just a hypothetical extrapolation. I asked the question... What is the cultural content that is being pushed in the selective sector? Because there's a unanimity of culture, if you like, and it's the people who are paying $200,000, for their children to get educated there, obviously seeking out that kind of culture. So the best approximation I could come up with was it's similar to what David Brooks described in his book Bobos in Paradise, which, if you're not familiar with it, with Bobos, that's Bohemian bourgeoisie. and basically these are wealthy people who believe it's okay to be rich as long as you have progressive values. It's very well explained in that book. But I think that's essentially the cultural content of the liberal arts colleges and the research universities as well. And what do they all stress? They stress multiculturalism, both race, class, and particularly gender. They stress globalism, great stress on international programs. They're very strong on environmentalism. Now, more recently, they have all been jumping on the bandwagon for civic engagement, having students become involved, and usually particularly involved in projects involving the first three of these.
And earlier referred to as service learning, now civic engagement.
Service learning was kind of menial, you know, but civic engagement means that you're a leader. You're engaged in trying to
make the world a better place.
That's right. Yes. That's right. Now, there's nothing wrong with any of these things.
Sure.
In fact, they're all very admirable, but they're all they sort of become stereotyped in the when they're put on the university homepage, and as they develop programs and courses and things to emphasize how innovative they are in offering basically the same thing that all the other colleges are offering in a different way.
And you think in some cases, at least, they can become just superficial, just a way to sort of attract students.
That's basically my argument, and a number of people who are very sympathetic to these causes have agreed that their institutions end up being superficial in these kinds of commitments. And it's a difficult question about how colleges and universities can do all the things that they have to do academically and intellectually and also push for these values.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today, and we're about halfway through our program with Professor Roger Geiger. His last name is spelled G-E-I-G-E-R. He's a distinguished professor and a named chair at Penn State University and senior scientist for the Center for the Study of Higher Education. He's a historian by training, and he's focused on higher education throughout his career at both Yale and University of Michigan and at Penn State since 1987. We'll be getting back to talking with Professor Geiger in just a moment or two, but my name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs on Sunday night here, brought to you by Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 in Urbana, and heard online at will.illinois.edu. That's will.illinois.edu/AM. And if you wish to hear part of this program that you might have missed or earlier programs, or if you'd like to refer other people to this program, it'll be archived at that same website in about a week. So you can find it at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And we're very informal, so we leave the G off of keeping. So keeping the faith at the end of will.illinois.edu. Next week, we'll be interviewing two folks who have been in charge of the Center for Jewish Students at the University of Illinois over the last year, Rafe Belhado and Jessica Cavanaugh Belhado. That'll be here on the 24th. of July. On the 31st, we'll be talking with Claudia Lenhoff and M.D. Pelmore about industrial pollution. That'll be on the 31st of July. On August 7th, Rabbi Alyssa Wise from the Jewish Voice for Peace will be our guest. Later in August, we'll be talking with Professor Richard Hult on the development of moral reasoning in children, and Professor Walt McMahon from the University of Illinois on also on education. What has your education done for you? Those are some of the programs up ahead here on Keeping the Faith. Again, my name is Steve Shoemaker, and let me give the phone numbers for listeners who'd like to join me in asking questions of our guest, Professor Geiger, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, or 1-800-222-9455 if it's a long-distance call. The particular article I've been referring to, I should have specified, came out in about a year ago as one of the publications from the Center for the Study of Higher Education, a working paper. It was called Postmortem for the Current Era, Change in American Higher Education by from 1980 to 2010. And as I mentioned earlier, I had it recommended to me as a very good overview of a lot of important changes that have happened in higher education over the last 30 years. Let's talk a little bit about what happens when people graduate from these institutions. And there's, we've hinted a little bit at the great differences between the selective schools and then the much larger group of the non-selective schools. For one thing, the graduation rate is very different. What are some of the other differences?
Well, economists have wrestled with this question of does it pay to pursue elite higher education? Do you get better returns from attending an institution in the selective sector? And by the time economists, social scientists dissect that question, it gets pretty complicated. But the overall answer is that the very best institutions certainly are a good investment, that their graduates do very well in their careers and earn more money, because that's the only way economists can measure doing well in your career. All the institutions in the selective sector are not alike. As you sort of move down that hierarchy, the rewards become somewhat less robust. And it also depends on what you're planning to do. if you want to be a lawyer, a liberal arts education in a liberal arts college can be a very good foundation. If you want to be an engineer, it probably would be better for you to go to the University of Illinois.
Although if you take some liberal arts colleges, it'll make your whole life better. Or take some liberal arts courses, it'll make your whole life better.
That's right. That's right. And the liberal arts colleges are, in that way, present themselves as a consumer good. They don't call it that, but, it is a consumer good. It's sort of a brand that you're buying, that you're going to wear the rest of your life. It's going to define the people you know and associate with, and it should make you much smarter and more aware. And of course, after you graduate, you can decide what to do with your life and go to graduate school.
And what about those from the non-selective schools? What are some of the generalizations that we could make about those who do finish?
Well, in general, it's well worthwhile. Graduating from college is really important. The returns to becoming a college graduate are much more than the returns to having some college. So persevering through graduation it really pays off no matter where you are. And And it often takes a long time, but probably the greatest value that college gives people is just a greater adaptability and an ability to sort of change jobs, to take on new learning when they need to, get a master's degree in something to if they want to change fields, and so forth. So people's trajectories through the labor force in during their careers are take all kinds of forms, but you're probably better off if you're a college graduate.
Let's talk about one of the surprising things to me that I read in your overview article, which is the focus in universities these days, research universities, on patents.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why that has come about and what's caused that.
Well, patents are really a byproduct of academic research, and they have been for a long time. But things changed in 1980 when the patent law was changed and allowed universities to retain title for their discoveries made with federally funded research. Before that, it was difficult. They could get permission, but it was a hassle.
So the universities as institutions could take some of that money that the patents generated for their own use in addition to sharing it with some of the faculty who made the discoveries and, I presume, with corporations that might have been funding that research?
Yeah, actually, that's part of the law.
Okay.
These financial returns have to be shared with the inventor and that anything left over is used for educational and research purposes.
By the university?
Yes. Uh-huh. Before that, universities were only lightly involved in patents. I think in 1980, there were 250 patents were awarded to universities, and now it's more like 4,000.
Wow!
And some universities managed their own patents, but most did not. Now every university has its intellectual property office that does this, and some of them do it very well, but it's more complicated than that because universities first sort of jumped into these things and started an intellectual property office, started a research park, waited for the money to roll in, and it really didn't. And what what eventually became clear is that if you want to develop intellectual property from university research, and really contribute to economic development, you have to help the process along. And so universities, they started establishing business incubators and encouraging faculty to start their own companies. And this is a much more targeted way of contributing to economic development. So the whole the offices involved with economic development have gotten much more elaborate and have gotten involved in the innovation process in a number of different points.
Doesn't it get confusing though when a university is trying to encourage a faculty to start sort of businesses on the side? And the university is getting a cut of what what profits are made, and the university is maybe not putting their stamp on the whole project, but they let themselves be referred to almost as if it's an imprimatur. And isn't there some conflict of interest here?
Well, the whole field is. Conflict of interest has sort of hovered over this field, but it's only a serious problem, really, in the biomedical field, mostly where people involved in the testing and clinical trials of pharmaceuticals are involved in the evaluation of these products. And they're, you know, millions of dollars can be riding on how these products are evaluated. And conflict of interest is a very difficult problem. But most university patents aren't that lucrative. In fact, most of them make no money at all. And it's very, very hard to found a startup company that amounts to anything.
Yeah.
So anyway, so universities really have to sort of help these things along if they want them to be successful. And if they do, they might come out ahead. But the only way they could really make a lot of money is when they get lucky with a biomedical patent.
Oh. Does undergraduate education suffer when there's so much focus, though, on both the universities making money and the faculty making money on the side?
Well, it's probably irrelevant to undergraduate education, but there are some graduate students who get involved in these startup companies or even have patents for themselves, and they're an important constituency. I think that overall, though, that this, if you look at the big picture and the trend towards university contributions to economic development, or I call it economic relevance, which is really being involved in the scientific fields that eventually are going to have an economic payoff. And the involvement in these fields is a wonderful thing for undergraduates. Many undergraduates get to work in laboratories during the summers. They get to major in fields that have a great deal that are growing and growing in economic importance. So the overall trend has been a positive one for undergraduate education.
Let's talk for a few moments about the role of government, both state government and federal government, in higher education today and how that's changed over the last 30 years. And let me again remind listeners, you may join this conversation at 333-9455 or long distance 1-800-222-9455. You point out that there isn't really an English word that's the opposite of privatization. You use the word publicness,
yeah.
But there's been the state and federal government have had such an important role in higher education, and yet that has shifted. Talk a little bit about some of the important changes over the last 30 years.
Well, most of these changes have been in the direction of privatization, but to understand them, you have to realize what an enormous public investment was made in higher education before that. And, of course, the building of our public systems of higher education after World War II, not only research universities, but the regional colleges, community colleges, was a tremendous investment. In 1950, one half of the students were in public colleges and universities, and by 1980, that was almost 80%. So it's the public sector has been pulling back from that point, and I already mentioned the decline in state appropriations for higher education. which, you know, has sort of come in waves with each of the four recessions that we've had to deal with. But beyond that, there's kind of a loss of moral support, a decline in the feeling that. Support for higher education is an important responsibility of state governments. And too often, people say, "Well, it's these are only private benefits that, and therefore the private individual should be the ones who pay for them." But I think research shows the opposite, that that there are important social benefits to higher education, which is why they always were supported. So this now you can also say that well it's because the states are forced to spend so much money on other things, particularly prisons. My state now spends more on prisons than it does on universities.
So does Illinois.
And then other expenses like Medicaid, which states have very little control over. So I mean, states have been under pressure, and higher education is one of the things that they can cut. But the cuts have been, I think, very detrimental to the open sector. It's there that the lack of investment, I think, and research tends to show, is partly responsible for this low completion rate. And and of course now the most states are trying to get more people to attend community colleges because they're cheaper for the state. But of course the completion rate for community colleges is the very lowest.
Professor Geiger, we have a caller on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes, the report and the news of what Dr. Geiger has discovered and publicized is very, very interesting over the last 30 years. I'm wondering if his research points to what's likely to happen in the next 10 years, or what lies ahead in this changing world of higher education?
Well, that's an excellent question. And in fact, I wrote this paper. I mean, it's called Postmortem for the Current Era, because I felt that after 30 years, these current trends had sort of run their course. But it's very difficult to perceive what's changing at an inflection point, if in fact, and I believe we are at a kind of turning point. So you look at, well, what are the big changes that are taking place? I mentioned the growth of for-profit higher education as one, and that is a disturbing trend. Another is, of course, the rising cost of higher education, which, if you know, we could only turn that around, would have tremendous benefits. But the more expensive public higher education becomes, the more competitive the for-profit sector is. So in a sense, this lack of public support for higher education is sort of encouraging privatization. On the positive side, what I was just talking about economically relevant research is really sustaining the universities and more the public universities. Public universities, because of their size, their breadth, and because they're invested in many more practical fields, which I don't have to tell people at the University of Illinois about, with your expertise in computers and software and agriculture. And these kinds of economically relevant fields are really leading the investments in research. And so far, in the Great Recession, which we still don't know the consequences of. So far, the funding for research and innovation has held up. But if the fiscal mess in Washington should become so dire that major cuts are made to federal support for research, this would be very bad for public universities.
Thank you. Appreciate these ideas about the future.
Thank you for the call. Following up on that call, Roger, would you talk about the for-profit colleges and universities that are that have just grown so much over the last several decades? You talked about part of that being disturbing and potentially harmful. Do you think that one of the reasons for this privatization in higher education is part of the reflection of the general culture of fear of big government, fear of state and federal run institutions or supported institutions? Is this part of the Tea Party movement?
Well, I don't think it has any kind of a philosophical justification at all. It's an economic phenomenon brought about by the availability of student financial aid. And the tuition price for these private for-profit colleges is equal to the maximum amount of financial aid that a student can qualify for. So this has been a profit, a very profitable opportunity for these corporations, and the corporations bought up the independent technical colleges. They expanded them. And as I said, their main goal is expansion, because that makes their stock price go up.
But how are they different from a diploma mill?
I have to be careful how I answer this.
I'm asking a mean question because our listeners are so nice.
Yeah. Well, some of them effectively are close to being diploma mills. Their approach is to make education available to all paying customers, to make it to reduce opportunity costs so that it's as easy to access as possible. And to make it not very rigorous. So I don't mean to condemn all the for-profit schools, because this sector of higher education used to play and still does play an important role in technical vocational education, which is a weak spot in the American system of higher education. So they used to be very good at getting students who hadn't done very well in high school, who hadn't done very well in the job market, and giving them the skills to become technicians, store managers, what have you, which are decent, well-paying occupations. The formula for replicating these institutions and spreading them has, I think, made them more responsive to the profit motive than to educational ends.
There's been a lot of talk recently, particularly at your institution, about the difficulties of dealing with corporations having influence over universities. Is that something new in higher education, or has that always been an issue?
Well, at Penn State, we have very good relations with corporations, particularly in the engineering school and the business school. The conflict of interest that you referred to earlier largely exists in medical schools and with pharmaceutical companies, but at Penn State, I think you know, the engineers, they will like to have participation with industry. And Penn State just received one of the largest federal grants ever, I think, more than $120 million from the Department of Education to build, to develop energy-efficient buildings. And this is a corporate university joint project, and a number of different universities as well. But there are probably 100 corporations that are participating in this. So that's the kind of influence you want to have from corporations when you're involved in these applying. You know, the very best academic research to a practical problem of great importance.
We're down to our last 30 seconds, but we do have one more caller. Yes, caller, you're on line one. Could you speak quickly?
Yes, I think that corporations are a huge problem in the universities. I think they're a problem at ISU in terms of the money that the wind power companies are giving. I think there are problems in our ag school at the U of I in terms of money coming from all over the place, ADM, everybody. So I'll hang up and listen.
Any response, Professor Geiger?
Well, I can only make a
suggestion. ISU is Illinois State University.
Yeah. I don't know the situation there. I know it can be very complicated in agriculture departments, too, where they claim that the corporations own all the intellectual property and they can't get it. But colleges of agriculture have to work with industry because that's part of the industry that they're dealing with.
But so do engineers and mining corporations.
And the problem we have in Pennsylvania right now is the drilling in the Marcellus Shale.
Right.
And there's the governor is all for it, and he has organized industry groups, and Penn State is kind of caught in the middle.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there, but all listeners who want to learn about that could go to This American Life last week, I know, talked about that in great detail. But I want to thank Professor Roger Geiger from Penn State University for talking with us about education today and changes in higher education over the last 30 years. And thanks also to our callers. Next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking about the last year of the Jewish Student Center here at the University of Illinois. The following week, we'll be talking about industrial pollution issues. The week after that, Rabbi Alyssa Weiss will be our guest talking about the Jewish Voice for Peace. August 21st, Richard Hult from South Carolina, University of South Carolina. We'll be talking about the development of moral reasoning in children. August 28, Professor Walt McMahon, what has your education done for you? I'm Steve Shoemaker, and thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL.